But unlike the rote math problems, they require idea generation and other aspects of elastic thinking. As I mentioned, elastic thinking is useful to our species, and so your brain takes pains to encourage it. As you take steps to solve a problem, the subtle stream of reward produced when you seem to be making progress is your emotional brain's way of keeping your attention trained along those lines. We've all experienced a conscious gut feeling that our thinking is on the right track, but we also experience unconscious coaxing that we're not mindful of, which guides the direction of our thinking nonetheless. It's easy to understand why we evolve to take satisfaction from problem solving. But as Pat Darcy's case illustrates, our brains have also evolved to make us happy when we engage in the arts. The exercise of artistic skills predates even the origin of our species. 1,400,000 years ago, our predecessor, Homo erectus, created the first aesthetic artifacts we know of, symmetrical hand axes. These look attractive, and that must have been the purpose of their symmetry, for to make them symmetrical, employing the bone, antler, and stone manufacturing tools of the day required a great investment of time and energy, and added little to their utility. Artsy hipsters today may adorn themselves with retro rings and earrings, but if you really want to be retro, try carrying around a symmetrical hand axe. That the exercise of elastic thinking skills, such as idea generation, pattern recognition, divergent thinking, and imagination, is inherently rewarding is the reason people have always put energy into the arts, despite the lack of material reward for most. In fact, material recompense can even get in the way of the pleasure we feel in such activities. Consider, for example, how the great Russian writer Fyodor Dostoevsky responded when a Russian publisher paid him a fairly large advance to write a novel. Note that he had not been given strict guidelines regarding what to write. He had merely been asked to write something in exchange for money. Despite that, in a letter to a friend, Dostoevsky wrote, "I believe you have never written to order by the yard and have never experienced that hellish torture." The hellish torture he referred to wasn't just a great novelist being a drama queen. The prospect of being paid for his work gave Dostoevsky writer's block. Dostoevsky's was not an isolated case. Many recent studies in social psychology suggest that monetizing creative output can disrupt the processes that lead to innovation. That contradicts the ideas of traditional psychology, which is full of papers investigating the importance of reward in encouraging or even controlling a person's behavior. But offering an extrinsic reward for an intrinsically enjoyable behavior can be counterproductive. Difficulty in original thinking arises, says psychologist Teresa Amabile, when you try for the wrong reasons. Our brains reward original and artistic thinking because those skills are important to any animal's ability to respond to change and unpredictability. It makes sense, then, that many animals make a display of their artistic nature when advertising themselves to a mate. Peacocks preen and songbirds warble. Young male zebra finches learn to sing by imitating adult males, and then, upon reaching sexual maturity, churn out diverse novel tunes of their own. Might artistic talent play a similar role in human mating? Might it, on an innate and unconscious level, indicate to a prospective mate that one has genes that could play a role in survival? Evolutionary psychologists Marty Hazelton and Jeffrey Miller tested that hypothesis by studying how women's taste in men changes at different stages of their ovulatory cycle. Hazelton and Miller knew that when women judge male attractiveness while they're at peak fertility, just before ovulation, they unconsciously give more weight than usual to indicators of evolutionary advantage, such as upper body musculature, beard growth, and jaw size. Those big guys pumping iron at the gym are chick magnets, but little do they know that the strength of their attractiveness depends on a woman's time of the month. Hazelton and Miller reasoned that if imagination is also a signal of mating fitness, artistic talent ought to have the same varying effect on women as a great set of pecs. To find out, Hazelton and Miller gathered 41 women in their 20s and recorded data on the timing of their cycles. Then he presented each of them with a carefully written description of two young men. The descriptions were designed so that the men had comparable qualities, except that one was artistic but poor, while the other was average in creative intelligence but wealthy. Though each woman would weigh those traits according to personal taste, the question was whether a given woman, at the time of month when her body was ready for reproduction, would have a greater tendency to choose the man more likely to generate creative offspring. If so, that would support the idea that artistic ability is a way we signal reproductive fitness. After reading the vignettes, the women rated each man's desirability on a scale from 1 to 9 and responded to the written question, "Whom do you think you might find more desirable for a short-term sexual affair?" The results were enlightening, especially if you are a poor male artist. Women's desirability ratings of the creative but poor men were strongly correlated with their degree of fertility, while fertility had no effect on their rating of the non-imaginative but rich men. As to the question of whom they would choose for an affair, the effect of fertility timing is quite striking. When their fertility was high, 92% of the women chose artistic ability over wealth. But when it was low, only 55% did. It's a cliche that artistic types have no trouble connecting with members of the opposite sex, but it's nice to know that at the root of that connection is the evolutionary importance of imagination. Attention deficit, elasticity surplus. In the early 1990s, a young University of Georgia pioneer in educational psychology named Bonnie Kramen noticed an oddity in the slowly growing literature on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. The children described in that research seemed to share many traits with those described in the research on gifted children. For example, both children with ADHD and gifted children were branded as distractible and having a gluttonous appetite for activity. Those sound like negative traits. In fact, when the disorder was first described in the early 20th century, doctors thought it was attributable to some sort of mild brain damage. That idea had been abandoned by the 1990s, but there was still a considerable stigma associated with an ADHD diagnosis. That bothered Kramen. What's more, she suspected that ADHD could actually be beneficial to one's thinking. Could those characteristics of ADHD be related to positive qualities, to ambition, productivity, and the ability to rapidly generate ideas? Kramen decided to administer what was essentially a test of elastic thinking to children diagnosed with ADHD, and conversely, to administer a test for ADHD to a group of children in a scholars program. She found astonishing overlap. A third of the ADHD group scored high enough to qualify for the elite and super selective scholars program, while a quarter of those in the scholars program were diagnosed with ADHD, 4 to 5 times the prevalence in the general population. For Kramen, that work was the beginning of a long career studying gifted children. Today, ADHD carries little stigma, and kids are sometimes misdiagnosed with the condition to satisfy parents seeking a, quote, cure for what is simply their child's natural and healthy, highly active state. The misdiagnosis issue is ironic because in recent years we've made great progress in understanding ADHD. We can now explain Kramen's results at the neuro level, which brings us back to the reward system and its role in what motivates people to explore both new ideas and new places. There is no single brain structure or system responsible for all the traits of ADHD, but the most critical traits can be attributed to the same ventral tegmental area to nucleus accumbens circuit in the reward system that Olds had stumbled upon. In ADHD, the dopamine receptors in those structures are impaired, resulting in a weakening of the brain's reward pathway. As a result, the steady stream of feel-good reinforcement that keeps others moving toward their goal is diminished. One consequence is that those with ADHD have difficulty performing some of the routine tasks of everyday life. But the disorder can also cause the opposite effect. Since it can make everyday life feel routine and boring, the brain tries to compensate by seeking more stimulation. As a result, when an ADHD brain comes upon a task it truly finds interesting, that is a task that briskly stimulates the reward circuits, it obsesses over it and becomes hyper-focused. The most famous ADHD trait is the one that concerned Craymond. It occurs when the weakened stream of reward is not sufficient to prevent one's attention from flitting from an issue at hand to stimuli in the environment, or to thoughts produced elsewhere within one's brain. As a result, like the children in a classroom overseen by a lenient teacher, the neural circuits of a person with ADHD shout out ideas with little focus or censorship. The intruding thoughts can send the individual off track, leading to a shift from one goal to another before that goal is achieved. But the stray thoughts sometimes prove relevant. When they are, they can produce unusual but constructive connections and associations that wouldn't have been thought of by, quote, normal people, making individuals with ADHD better at skills like idea generation and divergent thinking. For better and for worse, the thinking of those with ADHD is less constrained and more elastic. So, although many see ADHD as a disorder, one could also view it as tailor-made for today's turbulent and changing environment. ADHD might be, as Craymond speculated, an advantage at this stage of our evolution. That point of view is supported by an interesting new theory, which states that we evolved ADHD as an adaptation to the demands of change when we lived as nomadic hunter-gatherers. Those nomads lived in an environment that in some ways was much like our civilization today, ever-shifting and full of unpredictable threats. In that context, elastic thinking, flexible attention, and a thirst for adventure, especially exploration, could have been beneficial. The theory was tested in the study of the Areal, a Kenyan nomadic tribe. They had always been wandering animal herders, with low body fat and chronic undernutrition. Then, about 40 years ago, some of the nomads split off from the main group and settled in one place to practice agriculture. Recently, an anthropologist from the University of Washington studied, in both groups, the frequency of a variant of a gene that has been linked to ADHD. He found that among the wanderers, who confront constant change, those with the ADHD gene were, on the whole, better nourished. But among those who had settled, those with the trait were significantly undernourished. The nomadic areal with ADHD apparently were better equipped to thrive in their tempestuous environment, while the settled areal with ADHD were at a disadvantage in the many agricultural activities that require sustained focus. There was a lesson for us in that. Until just a couple decades ago, our society mirrored the settled areal, and ADHD might have been a hindrance. But in today's turbulent times, we are better likened to the nomadic areal, so ADHD may be an asset. ADHD is generally a condition of the immature brain, and when children grow up, they usually grow out of it. But whether or not we have ADHD, all of us have a greater or lesser propensity to explore or exploit, to wander or focus. Occupational research theorist Michael Curtin was ahead of his time when, in the 1970s, he captured that same distinction in his Adopters and Innovators theory of cognitive styles. Curtin described adapters as focused but rigid individuals who prefer to do things better by marshaling tried and true methods. They tend to be prudent and cautious and seem impervious to boredom. They can seem stuffy and unenterprising, wedded to systems and rules, wrote Curtin. Innovators, on the other hand, are elastic thinkers who like to find new approaches to problems. They are often distractible and poor at time management, and they produce less familiar and sometimes less acceptable solutions that, in the corporate world, often encounter resistance. They can also appear abrasive, even to one another, Curtin wrote. We may each have a preference for one type of thinker or the other, but companies need both, and those that don't have the proper balance, Curtin argued, run into trouble. That can be true of our personal relationships as well. An individual on one end of Curtin's spectrum is often best paired with an individual on the other end. By embracing the differences, the rule follower and rule breaker can balance each other and create a pair with the benefits, but not necessarily the drawbacks, of each individual's personality. The pleasure of finding things out. Imagine the following scenario occurring several million years ago. A primitive human of the species Homo habilis, the predecessor of Homo erectus, is wrestling down some small creature when he rolls over a sharp rock and slits open his own skin. After overpowering his prey, he is about to tear into its tough flesh with his teeth when his mind makes an association. The sharp rock tore my skin. I want to tear this animal's skin. I can use the sharp rock. For the millions of years of Homo habilis's existence, that crude stone cutter was its only original creation. Now flash forward a million and a half years. It is the early 1990s and Jerry Hirschberg, president of Nissan's California design studio, is wrestling with the design for the new Nissan Quest. One day, while driving down the road, he spots a couple at the curb struggling to get the back seat of a competitor's minivan out of the way so they can slide in a couch. A thought immediately pops into Hirschberg's mind. Install tracks that enable the driver to fold up the back seats and slide them forward to make space. Thus was born one of the most popular features of the Nissan Quest design. Both inventions were the result of someone's brain forming an association among seemingly unrelated ideas. Different eras, different species, same route to discovery. In nature, different atoms collide and combine to create molecules with properties unlike those of the atoms that form them. In our minds, one neural network in our brains overlaps with and activates another, and we compound diverse concepts and observations to form new ones. Though original thought in the arts, science, business, and personal life differs in its goals and context, at the level of neural networks, all those modes of thought arise from the association of different concepts in your brain. The mental equipment we use to solve business problems or to adjust to changing conditions in our personal lives is the same as the equipment we use to explore or create new art and music or theories in science. Just as important, the thought processes we use to create what are hailed as great masterpieces of art and science are not fundamentally different from those we use to create our failures. One aspect of those thought processes is how intrinsically rewarding they are due to the pleasure signals that our brains experience as we generate ideas. That is why there is wisdom in the saying that it is the journey that counts and not the endpoint. In fact, we often don't know how that endpoint will be valued by society until long after our act of creation. Think of Vincent van Gogh, who sold very few paintings in his lifetime, or Copernicus's heliocentric picture of the solar system, which impressed no one until Galileo adopted it some seven decades later. And then there is Chester Carlson, who, as I've mentioned, invented the photocopier. That was in 1938, but he couldn't sell it because companies, including IBM and General Electric, considered it a crackpot idea. Why would anyone want a complicated copier when people could just use carbon paper? I was lucky enough to learn many years ago to appreciate even the thought processes that lead to small ideas or to failed attempts. I learned it from the great physicist and Nobel laureate, Richard Feynman. Feynman brushed against a sharp rock of an idea when, as a graduate student in the 1940s, he came across an observation made by Paul Dirac, one of the fathers of quantum theory. He made a mental association between Dirac's comment and some ideas he was already thinking about. After years of hard work, that led him to invent an entirely new and exotic way to look at quantum theory, and a new mathematical formalism called Feynman diagrams to go with it. Like the Homo habilis stone tool, Feynman diagrams in physics are everywhere, the basis of much of the fundamental work in that science today. But if Feynman's plan had failed, if his mathematics had proved in the end to have a small flaw, his ideas would have been no less imaginative. In fact, Feynman sometimes took great pleasure in describing to me original ideas he'd invented and worked on that had led nowhere. Though scientists rightfully treasure only theories that work, we can also recognize the degree of intellectual beauty in a proposed theory, whether or not it ultimately proves successful. As for Feynman, he didn't see his most famous breakthrough as being different from any of the other problems he solved in his long career, whether big or small. or the little puzzles of ordinary life that he had to face like the rest of us. That a person who made a monumental and revolutionary contribution to his field could find equal pleasure in solving problems of far less significance is a testament to the fact that the exercise of elastic thinking is intrinsically rewarding. Feynman made that point especially well in a 1966 letter to one of his former PhD students, who, years after graduating, had written him and apologized for doing work that was not sufficiently important. To that, Feynman responded, "Dear Kyoichi, I was very happy to hear from you and that you have such a position in the research laboratories. Unfortunately, your letter made me unhappy, for you seem to be truly sad. It seems that the influence of your teacher has been to give you a false idea of what are worthwhile problems. A problem is grand in science if it lies before us unsolved and we see some way for us to make some headway into it. I would advise you to take even simpler, or as you say, humbler problems. You met me at the peak of my career when I seemed to you to be concerned with problems close to the gods. But at the same time I had another PhD student, Albert Hibbs, whose thesis was on the mundane topic of how the winds build up waves blowing over water in the sea. I accepted him as a student because he came to me with a problem he wanted to solve. No problem is too small or too trivial if we can really do something about it. You say you are a nameless man. You are not to your wife and to your child. You will not long remain so to your immediate colleagues if you can answer their simple questions when they come into your office. You are not nameless to me. Do not remain nameless to yourself. It is too sad a way to be. Know your place in the world and evaluate yourself fairly, not in terms of your naive ideals of your own youth, nor in terms of what you erroneously imagine your teacher's ideals are. Best of luck and happiness. Sincerely, Richard P. Feynman." Chapter 4. The World Inside Your Brain. How Brains Represent the World. In order for any word or concept to be the object of your thoughts, that word or concept must be represented in a neural network within your brain. Aristotle made an analogous point more than 2,000 years ago. Though he knew nothing of neural networks, he argued that human thought is based on internal representations of the world. And he distinguished between the image that reaches our eyes and the indirect perception of it in our thoughts. He also believed that women were deformed males and had fewer teeth. He was wrong about many things. But on this, regarding human thought, his was an accurate and important realization. For if there is no video screen in our brains that represents directly the optical data our retinas capture, then our brains must be translating and encoding that data, and any such process can both bias and restrain our thinking. It's not just the data from our senses that must be encoded in our brains, it's all data, from the fact that ice is frozen water to the conclusion that Satan is not a good name for your dog. And, as is true of the encoding of sensory data, the manner in which knowledge, ideas, and other information is represented has a substantial effect on the way you think about that information. For example, suppose you memorize a phone number. One obvious way to store that information is as a string of numerals, or as an image as if you had written it down. But your brain does not store it that way. To see that, try reciting a phone number backwards. It's easy to do if the phone number is written on a piece of paper, but difficult if you are reading it from your memory. That limitation arises from the manner in which your brain represents phone numbers. The issue of how to represent that which is to be thought about is an issue that must be solved by all information processing systems. For example, in 1997, IBM made headlines with a computer named Deep Blue, which defeated the reigning human chess champion, Garry Kasparov, in a six-game tournament. The first task the IBM team faced in designing Deep Blue was to determine how the program would represent the game internally in the guts of the machine. They decided to create a tree of possible moves and responses and a set of rules for rating the desirability or value of any given arrangement of pieces on the board. That representation determined what Deep Blue did when it pondered a move. It analyzed its tree of board positions. Kasparov's brain represented the problem of playing chess not as a tree of moves, but in a much more powerful way, as a collection of meaningful patterns. He viewed as a single unit, small groups of pieces that were mutually protecting one another, that were together attacking a piece, or that were controlling certain squares. Neuroscientists estimate that he could recognize about 100,000 distinct board positions composed of such clusters of pieces. To represent the game in terms of patterns of pieces is natural for the bottom-up neural networks that make up the human brain, while the tree of possibilities method the IBM programmers used is a natural way to represent data in a traditional top-down computer. The brain's approach is tailored to elastic thinking. It facilitates analysis in terms of overall strategy and principles and the ability to improve by learning. The tree approach is tailored to the step-by-step logical analysis that computers apply. It reduces each move decision to one huge mathematical calculation, which yields an answer, but no conceptual understanding, and far less potential for learning. Given unlimited time, a tree search could, in principle, always produce the optimal move. Since in practice, the time allotted is not unlimited, the quality of the computer's choices is a reflection of its hardware speed. Deep Blue was far faster at evaluating chess positions than was Kasparov. It could evaluate a billion in the time it took Kasparov to assess just one. That Kasparov gave Deep Blue a run for its money despite that speed disadvantage is a testament to the potency of the elastic thinking that a human brain can employ to set up and analyze problems. In the past decade, programmers have designed machines that play other kinds of games, with equally impressive results. In 2011, for example, IBM's computer Watson, with 4 terabytes of disk storage and access to 200 million pages of content, beat the reigning human champions at Jeopardy. Meanwhile, processors have become so fast that a $100 chess computer can now easily dispose of human world champions. In recent years, the computing community has realized the superiority of the manner in which biological systems process information. As I mentioned earlier, they are now trying to copy it, designing software that mimics our brain's bottom-up neural network. The effort has set off what has been called an arms race for talent in artificial intelligence. Google, after getting its feet wet creating the program that learned to recognize cats, led the way in adopting the non-traditional approach. See Chapter 2. Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon have now also jumped on the bandwagon. The effort has already borne fruit. For instance, in a computer that can beat the best human at the game Go, and a greatly improved version of Google Translate. Though an improvement on the traditional approach, the neural net systems of today have internal representations tailored specifically to the applications they will be used for, and have no ability to adapt their processing if the task they were designed for is altered, much less to apply their intelligence in a wide range of diverse domains. They are excellent at learning in a, quote, highly structured situation, said one AI expert, but still, quote, it's not really human-level understanding. As a result, even today's most advanced computers are nothing like the general problem solver hoped for in the early days of artificial intelligence. Computer scientists had to build one machine to play Go and another to power the process of language translation. A single human brain can handle both tasks, and it can do so while controlling your balance so you can stand on one foot. Such flexibility is obviously necessary in animal brains, for we face a multitude of situations in life and cannot have a separate brain for each. To solve the unforeseen problems faced by complex life forms, we animals have evolved an elastic mind that can create representations spontaneously and without outside intervention, the skills necessary for survival in our world of flux. That's the miracle of biological information processing. And so, if you want to make a general problem solver today, the best way is still to find a mate and create a new human being. How brains create meaning. Think of what happens when an event as simple as the activation of a doorbell occurs. It's easy to make the mistake of believing that our perception of that event as a ringing sound is the physical reality, but it isn't. The physical reality of the doorbell's action is the wave-like propagation of a disturbance of air molecules. A microphone that picks up the doorbell's sound would represent it as the modulation of an electric current that could be transmitted, say, to a speaker that could read it and reproduce it. A radio transmitter would represent the same physical phenomenon as the modulation of an electromagnetic wave. A computer would represent it by a series of zeros and ones encoded in the quantum state of its circuitry. A snake resting in your home would sense the doorbell's activation from the manner in which the air vibrations jiggle the floor upon which its jaw rests, and create from that sensation its conception of events, whatever that is. In our own brains, the doorbell's physical sound is transmitted by the ear and represented by the state of a network of neurons in the auditory cortex and our temporal lobes. We experience it as a ringing, but that representation is no truer than the other four I just mentioned. It is merely a fabrication that allows us to process the information and calculate an appropriate response. Some people, with a condition called synesthesia, will perceive the doorbell's activity as a color as well as a sound. That some human brains translate the vibration of air molecules into the perception of a hue may seem odd. From the point of view of physics, however, the representation of the bell as a sensation we call sound is no more natural than perceiving it as a sensation we call color. In fact, no one knows what a snake or a bat or a bee experiences when it perceives a doorbell, or how an intelligent alien would experience it, for there is no reason to believe they do so via the same ringing sensation that we experience. In whatever manner an organism represents the physical sound, that is only the beginning. All species, if they are to survive, must process and react to important stimuli in their environment, and so, to their sensory input, they must assign meaning. One of the key features that distinguish mammals is that their brains assign many levels of meaning in a manner that is more sophisticated than in any other animal. We experience a doorbell as a ringing sound, but it also has associations that may signify interruption, that solicitor again, or social connection, my friend is here, or gratification, the FedEx man is bringing the cashmere sweater that I ordered. That single disturbance of air molecules triggers a cascade of related meanings, physical, social, and emotional. So, although in school we learned that the defining traits of mammals are that they have hair, give birth to live young, and suckle their babies, just as important is the unique way that mammals think. One of the mammal's brain's tricks in creating meaning is to group diverse elements into a single compound unit, and to group compound units into still higher level units, and so on. Scientists call the ideas and groups of ideas represented by those hierarchies, fittingly, concepts. For example, the concept grandma may include traits such as smile lines, gray hair, and keeps her teeth in a jar. Whatever it includes for you, the concept grandma is also subsumed under a larger concept, grandmothers, which is itself a subset of the concept, older people. Imagine spotting your grandmother unexpectedly. How do you process the data your eye picks up? The visual data of her skin coloring, eyes, hair, etc., is quickly transmitted to an area of your brain called the visual cortex, but it takes some milliseconds before you give that data meaning. If she is wearing gold sunglasses and a hat decorated with plastic bananas and pears, and if you spot her out of context while you are on vacation in Hawaii, where you weren't expecting her to be, her identity might register only after several seconds and feel like a minor epiphany. The delay is indicative of the processing that is occurring in your brain. But what kind of computation is that? We don't yet fully understand the process, but we do know that your brain is not literally registering each bit of the woman you see as optical data, the way a computer might, pixel by pixel, then searching a database of images, and finally matching the data with a stored image of grandma. That would be exceedingly laborious, because sometimes you see grandma in bright light and sometimes in deep shadows, head on or from the side or back. wearing a huge hat with Trude on it or hatless, laughing or frowning, etc. The variables are practically infinite. If our brains searched the database of grandma shots, we'd have to store all such images to represent her, or else we'd need an algorithm to generate them from some standard views. An incredibly fast computer like Deep Blue can get away with that approach to information processing, but our human brains can't. Instead, a higher level of processing is going on, related to clusters of pixels, her features. Just as to Kasparov, it was clusters of pieces that formed the meaningful units, to you, it is a collection of features, including non-visual traits such as personality, that form your representation of your grandmother, your grandma concept. We know this because there are neurons in your brain that will fire whenever you see her. But those same neurons fire if you simply see her name written out in text, or hear it spoken, or are reminded of some aspect of her. Neuroscientists call the neurons and networks that represent concepts, concept cells, or concept neurons. We have networks of concept cells for people, places, things, even for ideas such as winning and losing. I used the image of your grandmother to illustrate the idea of concept cells because they used to be called grandmother cells. The term was invented when neuroscientists didn't think that such cells existed, and it was meant to be derisive and sarcastic. As in, you can't really believe that your brain reserves a network of cells for thoughts of your grandmother. But scientists changed their tune when those cells were actually discovered in 2005, and they also changed their terminology. In those first experiments, scientists took advantage of electrodes that had been implanted deep into patients' brains in the course of treatment for severe epilepsy. The electrodes allowed them to observe the individual neurons in their subjects' brains, responding to photos of places like the Eiffel Tower and the Sydney Opera House, and famous people like the actresses Jennifer Aniston and Halle Berry. The researchers were shocked to find that the same network could, for example, pick out Berry as viewed from different angles and even when masked as Catwoman. Today, researchers believe that humans have in this regard by far the greatest capability of any mammal. We are capable of encoding in our neurons tens of thousands of different concepts, each composed of a network of about a million concept neurons, about as many as are in an entire wasp brain. Concept networks are the building blocks of our thought processes. Each of these networks can be accessed independently. The fact that neurons are shared among different networks seems to be the root of the associations we make between different concepts, for it allows the activation of one neural network to spread to another. When we are faced with a question or come upon new information, we operate on those concepts, perhaps merging or splitting them, or calling up a new concept on the basis of an association. By stringing such thoughts together, we are led to conclusions. Every concept we ever conceive takes the physical form of a constellation of neurons in a concept network. They are the realization and hardware of our ideas. Ours is a far more complex process than occurs in a computer, an insect brain, or even the brains of other mammals. It allows us to face the world armed with the capability for an astonishing breadth of conceptual analysis. That's why, now that most of the existential struggles of the wild are behind us, we humans can turn our powers to pursuits not seen in the natural world. We can create Velcro, quantum theory, abstract art, and maple bacon donuts, because the elasticity of our thinking allows us to move beyond the existing world of our senses and invent new concepts. So, while other animals have to chase down their prey across vast fields, we get to run on a treadmill, then stick a box of Lean Cuisine in the microwave, and feast on a concoction of autolyzed yeast, maltodextrin, sodium aluminum phosphate, and 70 other ingredients that the manufacturer calls sesame chicken. The bottom-up brilliance of ants. Once information is represented in the brain, what happens next? How do brains process that information? The neurons in our brain are, in one sense, simple objects. Each receives thousands of electrochemical signals per second from other neurons to which it is connected. Like the zeros and ones that constitute the language of digital computers, these signals come in two types, excitatory and inhibitory. The neuron applies no intelligence when assessing these input signals. It simply adds up the excitatory signals and subtracts from them the inhibitory signals. If the net input over a short period is large enough, the neuron fires, sending its own signal, which may be either excitatory or inhibitory, to the other neurons to which it is connected. How do the thoughts and intellect of all animals arise from this primitive decision-making prowess of individual neurons? Simply whether to fire or not to fire? If the behavior of a mother goose is a good model for automatic, non-thinking behavior, the insect world provides a potent example of how intelligent information processing can arise from simple rules obeyed by a large number of individual components. That's because, faced with a challenging and often changing environment that overwhelms their simple pre-programmed abilities, certain insects evolved a method of inventive group processing that, like our neurons, creates an intelligent response from a group of unintelligent components, the individual insects. The insects that do this, which include ants, bees, wasps, and termites, are called social insects. From the point of view of evolution, they are the most successful of all insects. Though they make up just 2% of the insect species in the world, they thrive in such great numbers that they form more than half the Earth's insect biomass. In fact, though each individual is less than 1/1,000,000th the size of a human, if all the ants in the world could be placed on a scale, their weight taken together would equal that of all the humans in the world. The term social insect is in a way a misnomer, for these animals don't care one bit about their cohorts. They don't have friends, and if they hang out at cafes, it is to eat the morsels you drop, not to meet with their friends. In fact, that's my point. The members of social insect species are mindless automatons, each responding to its environment through a set of simple program scripts. But what distinguishes the social insects is that, over millions of years of evolution, those mindless scripts have developed in a way that, taken together, allows them to process information in a new way. As individuals, their mode of information processing is scripted and rigid, but as a group, it is elastic. So as a group, though not as individuals, they can evaluate complex new situations and take meaningful action. They have a collective intelligence that is called, in the terms of mathematical complexity theory, an emergent phenomenon. To see how that works, consider how ants adjust the way they explore for food when the physical boundaries of their available territory shrink or expand. Since there is no ant in charge, there is no central plan. Yet if you place the ants in a 10-by-10-foot arena and then suddenly double each dimension, the ants will process that information and change their pattern of exploration to effectively explore the larger area. Though no single ant comprehends what has changed, as a group, they recognize the change and respond to it. What looks like intelligent behavior on the group level is but a simple algorithm on the level of the individual ant. Each ant, with its antennae, senses when it encounters another ant and, employing a fixed formula, adjusts its exploration path according to the frequency of those encounters. That's a simple example, but the same kind of unsupervised reasoning allows ants as a collective to accomplish many intelligent feats. Army ants organize hunting raids involving up to 200,000 workers. Weaver ants create chains made from their own bodies, allowing them to cross wide gaps and tug leaf edges together to form a nest. Leafcutter ants chop the leaves off plants in order to grow fungi. Arizona harvester ants send foragers looking for food, but if it rains and there is damage to the nest, those ants change jobs to provide more maintenance labor to clean up the mess. All this is achieved without any executive ant orchestrating the group's attention, reasoning, planning, or actions. On the whole, colonies of social insects exhibit so cohesive a collective mind that some scientists like to think of the colony, rather than the individual ants, as the organism. That applies even to the reproduction, says Stanford scientist Deborah Gordon. Ants never make more ants. Colonies make more colonies, she says. The process goes like this. Each year, on the same day, no one knows how the colony accomplishes that feat of timing, each colony sends out its winged males and virgin queens, who fly to a mating ground where they copulate. Then, all the males die, while each queen flies to some new spot. There, she sheds her wings, digs a hole, lays eggs, and starts a new colony. With that, the original colony has reproduced. That colony with its queen will live for 15 to 20 years. Each year she will lay more eggs to replenish it, still using sperm from that original mating. Most of her offspring are wingless workers incapable of reproduction, but some are new queen ants and the males who exist solely to fertilize them. If you think about it, the way social insect societies function is completely foreign to us. Our corporations and organizations have hierarchical structures, with an individual or small group at the top directing the activities of those below, who may in turn govern the activity of those at lower levels. To have a country or company with no one in charge is virtually inconceivable to us. We call it anarchy. But the ant queen, unlike human royalty, does not hold authority or implore other ants to carry out any action. No executive ant directs the behavior of any other ant. That is how ant colonies operate. As many as 500,000 ants do just fine, with no management at all. The evolutionary goal of all organisms is to understand and react to their environment in a way that is effective enough that they survive to reproduce. But the individual insects of an ant colony don't integrate information and form a unified representation of the world or of the problems they must solve. They make only simple decisions based on what they sense in their immediate environment. They are ignorant of the opportunities and threats posed by what's around them, and of their colony's goals and issues, and they receive no instructions regarding how to react. Instead, the ant's representation of the environment and its challenges are encoded in the colony. Countless interactions among individuals obeying simple pre-programmed rules result in the choices and behaviors of the colony as a whole, allowing it to thrive. This is a classic example of bottom-up processing, in contrast to the top-down processing performed by organizations and programmed computers. As I've mentioned, our brains employ both. In top-down processing, the brain's executive structures orchestrate our reasoning, while bottom-up processing produces unorchestrated, elastic thinking. Your brain's hierarchy. Our neurons are the ants of the human brain, producing the emergent phenomenon we call human intelligence. But we have 86 billion neurons, which is almost 200,000 times the number of ants in a typical colony. Also, unlike ants, which communicate with one or two other ants at any given time, each of our neurons is connected to thousands of other neurons via structures called axons and dendrites. Due to that great complexity, the neurons in our brain possess several levels of organization. The brain appears superficially as a uniform mass of bulges and folds, but it is actually divided and subdivided into specialized regions. Neighboring neurons are connected into structures that perform specific functions, and those structures may themselves form part of larger structures, and so on, something like Russian nesting dolls. At its largest scale, the outer layer of the brain's neural tissue is called the cortex. It is divided by a fissure into right and left hemispheres, and each hemisphere is divided into four lobes. Within each hemisphere, the frontmost lobe, the frontal lobe, is where the brain integrates information to produce thought and action. Like the other lobes, the frontal lobe is further subdivided. In particular, it contains the prefrontal cortex, one of the stars of this book. Found only in mammals, the prefrontal cortex is the key structure that allows us to rise above the automatic response to environmental triggers that come from scripted behavior. Acting as the brain's executive, it supervises our thought and decision-making by identifying objectives, guiding attention and planning, organizing behavior, monitoring consequences, and managing the tasks performed by other areas of the brain, a role analogous to that which a company's CEO performs. The hierarchy goes on for several more levels. The prefrontal cortex, for example, is made of smaller structures, such as the lateral prefrontal cortex, an evolutionary advance found only in primates, which I'll talk about in Chapter 9. The lateral prefrontal cortex, in turn, is made of yet smaller structures, such as the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And that structure, as I mentioned in the introduction, is itself made of a dozen substructures. The structures at each level are interconnected in a complex manner, receiving input from some and providing input to others. They are also connected to other structures that sit below the cortex, such as the substantia nigra, the ventral tegmental area, and the nucleus accumbens of the reward system. Each structure performs tasks that contribute to the higher-level processing performed by the larger structures of which it is part. Ant colonies don't have that complex and hierarchical organization, and they don't complement their bottom-up processing with a degree of top-down control. In humans, the executive brain helps us rise above the realm of purely habitual or automatic behavior by suppressing some thoughts and activating others. If your boss is unfairly berating you, it is your executive brain that allows you to save your anger for later, when you'll be sticking pins into the voodoo doll of your boss. Yet, in its attempt to suppress seemingly ill-advised or irrelevant ideas, your executive brain can impede original thinking. When we are at our best, our executive eases up enough that the brain achieves a balance of bottom-up and top-down operation. It is the balance of these modes of operation that determines the focus and breadth of your thinking. That's the beauty of the human mind. We can execute an interplay of top-down and bottom-up processing, and of analytical thought and elastic thought. From that mix, ideas emerge that are organized and focused towards some end. Many of them ideas that are not deducible using purely logical steps. We can program ourselves, we can create new concepts, and best of all, we can alter our approach until we solve whatever problem the changing conditions of our environment have put before us. An intellectual adventure. Our brains can operate in a top-down or bottom-up manner, but so can the individuals and organizations. Of all intellectual endeavors, academic science is one of the most bottom-up in the way it functions. Young scientists are invited to join research groups, but they're given a lot of freedom to follow their own ideas, rather than being dictated to from the top down by the group leader. That's especially true in theoretical physics, where the startup cost of pursuing a new idea isn't much more than the price of a pad of yellow paper. In the corporate world, bottom-up functioning is rare, and rigid goal-directed thought is often valued over elastic thinking. Could corporations become smarter if they allowed for a greater degree of bottom-up processing? One executive who believes the answer is yes is Nathan Myhrvold, who built the company Intellectual Ventures, IV. Myhrvold was a recent physics PhD who, for about a year, had been working under Stephen Hawking when he took a summer leave of absence to start a business with some old school buddies. That leave turned into 2 years, and then the company was bought by Microsoft. Myhrvold did well in Seattle, starting Microsoft's research division and staying until 1999. Just how well that worked out for him is clear from an exchange he and I had at his current lab near Seattle. He proudly showed me an expensive precision miniature screwdriver set he had just splurged on. I went back and forth on this quite a bit because $250 is a lot to spend on tools like this, he said. But I decided I could treat myself. After all, I own my own jet. As Myhrvold told me this, he erupted with an enthusiastic and thunderous laugh. In his late 50s, jolly and cherubic, with a ruddy complexion, a sandy beard, and disheveled hair, he makes me think of a Santa Claus who's letting go after having had a few drinks. But this Santa's elves don't make children's toys. The scientists at IV, which he financed by leveraging connections he'd made at Microsoft, work on nuclear physics, optics, and food science. Intellectual Ventures' goal is to create strange ideas that others don't think of, or that are considered misguided, and then license them. Myhrvold structured and developed the company to function like the human brain, a lot of interconnected people working together with only minimal direction from above. That is why it is so interesting. It is perhaps unique as a corporation with bottom-up governance. How did the bottom-up approach work out? Just look at Ivy's innovative products. A recurring theme at the company is finding novel uses for waste. One project seeks to turn the discarded outer hulls of coffee beans into an edible gluten-free flour that could be mixed with ordinary flour to help feed the world's poor, an effort funded in part by Myhrvold's friend Bill Gates. The coffee flour would be a boon to impoverished countries for two reasons. First, the flour would cost just half as much as wheat flour, which for the most part has to be imported. Second, it would give coffee growers in the developing world a big bump in profits. Consider the coffee you buy for $15 a pound. That translates to about $5 per pound to the coffee growers. But it costs, on average, $4.90 to grow that coffee, so they are making a profit of only 10 cents. Myhrvold's company would haul their hulls away, saving the growers 5 cents, and then pay them an additional 5 cents, thus doubling the growers' profit, while obtaining the raw material for the coffee flour at a cost that's low enough to make the final product much cheaper than flour made from wheat. Reworking coffee waste doesn't sound very sexy, but its impact could be enormous. Coffee growers generate billions of pounds of discarded hulls each year. Another Ivy effort that raises eyebrows is called the photonic fence, an invention built around a laser that can shoot and kill flying bugs, a la Ronald Reagan's Star Wars missile defense system. It's aimed at reducing the incidence of malaria in Africa, as well as stopping the carnage winged insects impose on crops. The photonic fence is a quintessential example of the power of elastic thinking, the integration of wildly diverse ideas. First, from the mosquito experts, Ivy engineers learned that, late in the day, the insects fly toward the sunset, but will stop and hover over a shadow or dark spot on the ground. Such areas are like a pickup joint for mosquitoes, where males encounter females and mate. Then there were the optics experts, who taught them about a technology called retroreflective coatings, which will shine light back directly at a source no matter what angle it comes from. By setting up a retroreflective screen behind the mating area and aiming a low-powered targeting laser at it, the Ivy researchers are thus able to discriminate the shape, size, and wing beat frequency of any bugs in the beam's path. That allows them to identify the species and even the sex of the bug, which is important in fighting malaria because only the females are disease carriers. Finally, from laser experts, they learned how to aim a higher power laser at a targeted bug. In that manner, the apparatus can kill up to 10 mosquitoes per second, using just the energy of a 60-watt light bulb. Ivy does not manufacture any of its inventions. It makes money by buying, selling, and licensing patents like those related to the photonic fence. That can be controversial because some say that reserving ideas at such an early stage stifles innovation. But the Ivy strategy has been working. Photonic fence is now in the commercialization phase, coffee flour is already bringing in revenue, and Ivy has been spinning out on average a company every year. This is important because it demonstrates the potential of applying what we have learned about the information processing in our minds to the way people are organized to attack real-world problems together. Part 3. Where New Ideas Come From. Chapter 5. The Power of Your Point of View. A Paradigm Shift in Popcorn. David Wallerstein was not someone you would have thought of as a master of innovation. A young executive at the state Balaban and Katz theater chain in the 1960s, he spent his time worrying about the bottom line in what was, even then, a marginal business. Then, as now, it wasn't the sale of film tickets that generated the bulk of revenue for a theater. It was selling salty popcorn and the sweet Coke to wash it down. Wallerstein, like everyone else, focused on increasing the sales of those high-margin concessions, and, like everyone else, he tried all the conventional profit-building tricks. 2-for-1 deals, matinee specials, etc.